Welcome to Justice Studio Sessions. I am Marianne Moore, foundress of Justice Studio. During these sessions, we will be exploring the social justice themes that have emerged through Justice Studio's work, showcase grassroots activism, and deep dive into ethical and equitable research and consultancy methods. Stay tuned to learn more about the complexities of social justice and how you can turn your passion into action. Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to the final episode of Series 1 in Justice Studio Sessions. This is the 15th episode, and I'm very pleased for this episode to be joined by Dr. Iram Ali. Dr. Iram Ali is a social scientist and consultant committed to providing robust evidence-based support to help build resilient and impactful institutions. She joined us for episode 2 of Justice Studio Sessions, where we discussed food banks, and so you'll probably remember her. She has nearly 2 decades of experience working in both the academic and charity fields, working on a range of different projects across research, policy, and evaluation. Her current areas of interest lie in diversity, equity, and inclusion in the charity sector, and the impact of poor public service provision on marginalised communities and race equality policy. This episode is essentially Dr. Iram Ali and I having a little bit of a rant and a little bit of a talk about how we feel it is to run a social justice consultancy and what the challenges are in that, in running a small organisation in an industry dominated by certain big players, and when you're trying to run a very values-led and equity-focused business. We discuss a whole range of issues, particularly thinking about how we got into the industry and what our personal challenges have been as we've navigated our way through it. I hope you enjoy the discussion. Hello, Iram. It's very nice to speak to you today on the podcast. It's great to have you here.
Hi, it's lovely to be here. Thanks for having me on.
And we're going to talk about public sector, charity consulting industry and ethical consulting and all of the kind of things that come along with that, because of course you run your own consultancy, I run my own consultancy as well, so we will be exploring different themes within that. But it would be really great if you could kind of first tell us a bit about your background and how you began working in the consulting industry.
Yeah, so I started my career working in non-governmental organisations in Bangladesh in the early 2000s, so 20 years ago now, at a time when Bangladesh was really the crucible for kind of innovative development interventions like microfinance and kind of lots of gender, you know, work around gender and development. So I worked with Grameen Bank, and which was, you know, the pioneers of microfinance, and also with BRAC, which is still the largest NGO in the world, currently worked across education, health, microfinance, social enterprises. I did a mid-career PhD, which kind of moved me into academia and research. So I did a doctorate in sociology at Oxford, and then became very disillusioned with academia. So in kind of the mid-2010s, had a career break where I kind of really sat down and thought, well, what is it that I want to do in the world? And I found academia really isolating. And I found, you know, often we were talking in very small rooms to each other. And these small rooms were, you know, academics all across the world, virtually or in person. And coming from a background of kind of boots on the ground work, being in academia felt really restrictive because, you know, we were only writing. And as I said, felt like we were talking to kind of a very small group of people. So I thought, well, how can I kind of organically combine my research skills and my previous, you know, work in non-governmental organizations and charities, and kind of organically moved into freelancing research for small organizations, kind of on an ad hoc basis. And then in 2021, I set up my own consulting shop organization with a colleague of mine, Dr. Sahil Wasi, who's an anthropologist, I'm a sociologist. but we both have experience in NGOs and charity in the charity sector. And we kind of wanted to do consulting differently. We wanted to take on projects that meant something to us. We wanted to work with small charities at a price range that would be affordable to them and provide expertise that they might not previously have access to. And also, we're both two brown immigrants in the UK who've made our lives and our homes here. And we think that we, but also have very international backgrounds. And we kind of want to bring that perspective into the consulting world as well.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. It must have been really, it's quite interesting that you talk about being working for BRAC and Grameen Bank, because when, a lot of us read about social entrepreneurship and all of the kind of really good things that can happen within the sector, there is a lot of emphasis on these two organizations and microfinance and what happened within those and at that time. Can you say anything more about kind of what it was like to be part of that, right in the center of everything there?
I could talk to you probably for the whole hour about that. It was an amazing time. It was a time that felt so, 1995, the back end of the 90s was when, the Bretton Woods institutions really decided that, their development strategy globally would be to funnel money into non-governmental organizations. They were like, well, global South governments are too corrupt. And so we are going to really push funding for NGOs to get the job done and to go to places where governments aren't able to go and aren't willing to go. And so suddenly there was this huge influx of aid money from, global North nations and Western nations into places like Bangladesh. And we had international NGOs like Save the Children, the United Nations, the German bilateral aid agency, the USAID, Canada Aid, all of those. But also you had these organizations like BRAC and Grameen, which were homegrown and which took the approach that we know best how to, create solutions or interventions for our own people. And, I worked directly with Dr. Muhammad Yunus just kind of in the early days of microfinance. And I worked in the wing of Grameen Bank that basically sprang out of, called Grameen Trust, that sprang out of loads of people from all over the world coming to him and saying, we'd like to do this in our own country. How can we? Mm-hmm. And so it was part of my job to basically write down processes and research to allow us to give a kind of like a package to a fellow charity organization or NGO in Bolivia or Peru or wherever else and say, this is how you build, operate, and transfer a microfinance organization. So it felt amazing. It felt like a time where anything was possible. And I was just surrounded by really passionate people who were very devoted to doing on the ground work. And it was, and during that time I traveled. So both for my PhD research and during that time, I've traveled all over Bangladesh across all five districts for years. And it's grounding and humbling. And it sounds weird to say it now sitting in my living room in London, but kind of my politics around social justice and liberation, that's where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Those early days of, and we can talk a lot about where the industry's gone since in the global South around development and aid. And that industry is rife with problems and issues. But in those days, it really felt that we were working for a collective good.
Mm-hmm.
And microfinance, again, I did my MPhil research on microfinance as well. It felt like this kind of opening of possibility. Obviously, there's a lot we can say about microfinance. But yeah, that it's just a time of real enthusiasm and a feeling in Bangladesh specifically, and I know you've been to Bangladesh as well, that we could do it, that we could export expertise and operationalizing development interventions to other countries, that we didn't need to look for models and ways to the West, that we didn't need to look to the global North. We could say, hey, look, we're making stuff ourselves. And that felt amazing. And that felt really, inspiring.
Yeah, no, it sounds really amazing. And I feel like I've read so many books about that time, but it must have been amazing to actually been there. It's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think in a way, I sort of began my career in Bangladesh myself, because it was my first experience of working with an NGO. So I did the kind of very typical thing, kind of very typical Western thing of kind of, well, I saved up so that I could come and volunteer, you know, internationally. It was kind of like part of the thing that you do. I'd already done my degree, but I really knew I wanted to work in the industry, in the social justice industry, in the international development industry. And so I kind of like, I don't know, I worked at a bar and I worked in the Home Office as a temp. And then I kind of saved up so I could come to Bangladesh. And Bangladesh was kind of a massive kind of wake up call for me, because I'd never been anywhere like it in my life. Mm-hmm. You know, I was raised in England and I'd been to Europe, but I hadn't been out of there. And I think it made a massive impact how I saw the international development industry and how it related to the local people, mm-hmm. how cut off it was,
yeah.
how there was a real sense of, you know, these kind of important diplomatic rich Western people going around in their nice 4x4s along the street, and then mm-hmm. outside there was all this poverty. You know, they'd go in their car to the embassy,
the project site, yeah
and then but it really was so cut off. And I felt really angry experiencing that, because I really realized the kind of hypocrisy within the development sector. And also it just seemed such a shame that, you know, there were so many people, and definitely like loads of people in Bangladesh that were doing loads of like cool stuff and who really did care about the population, but there did feel a real hypocrisy within the industry, and it quite inspired me to want to work in it, but from a critical lens. And I already felt quite critical of the UK public sector as well, having temped in the Home Office. I was kind of like a very critical young woman who felt like, okay, I need to do something about this, thinking, you know, naively that I could really do something about it. And that was what inspired me, these kind of collective experiences of seeing the kind of stagnancy. And I don't know, there was a real apathy within the civil service. It felt like a kind of bureaucracy for bureaucracy's sake. There didn't seem to be much passion. And then again, this problem with the international development space. And it was those two things that made me think, I really want to work in this sector. But I was an impatient person. I'm still quite impatient now. And I just wanted to get stuck in. And for me, I realized that the best way of getting stuck in was to start doing consultancy, because you could kind of immediately start doing projects. So that's the route I took. I kind of went to these different public sector consultancy firms and kind of sharpened my teeth on these different projects, and then tried to maneuver myself to do the things I wanted to do, which was very much around children and children's rights and children to do with the justice system, because that was what was a real passion of mine from a young age. So I think it's interesting, isn't it? Like when you think about the different strands, like from your strand of academia and also the experience of being in Bangladesh at that time, that's kind of coalesced to give you that rounded feeling of how you can address social justice issues within the public and the charity sector
in the UK. yeah
and I think it's quite interesting to draw on those strands, because mm-hmm. as I say, I feel like I've come from much more of a management consulting background, mm-hmm. although I've continued to do research as I've gone along and do a master's and things like that in my spare time, so I'm not left the academic, but you've come from a very different, you know,
yeah,
set of skills.
Yeah, I think I kind of want to pick up on a point you're talking about kind of the stagnancy of the international aid and development sector. And I think what I want to add to that is also, as a Bangladeshi who has immense educational and class privilege, working in that sector, supposedly on behalf of my own people, you are then the interlocutor between the white development professionals coming in their Pajeros and their four-wheel drives with their, you know, unlimited budgets, and the people that you are hoping whose lives to improve. But then you're in the position of representing Bangladeshis and kind of, you know, something I kind of have reflected on when thinking about coming here today, that so much of the work I do is based, it comes from a position of multiplicity and intersectionality. And that really started very early on in my career, because I was like, well, I'm a rich brown person who has all of the privilege in the world, and I get to go home and sleep in my warm bed in my middle-class family in Bangladesh and have everything. And I'm supposedly speaking for our beneficiaries and our stakeholders who don't have any of these things. And, you know, I'm the one, because I speak perfect English and I have degrees from internationally recognized universities, that immediately when the donors come, they will, you know, they would make a beeline for people like me, right? Because we speak the same language. We speak that, you know, that global language of, you know, a certain middle class access And they would immediately talk to me, and I would be like, no, speak to my colleague who's, you know, from the village and who's actually, you know, he's the one implementing the project. Please, his expertise. And they'd be like, yeah, but because it's hard to interface through a interpreter or through, you know. So I think it's not only you as an outsider coming in and then seeing the system for what it is, it's those of us who were inside the system in a very kind of two-pronged position, feeling, am I really doing good here? And then, you know, as the industry became more and more professionalized and we were kind of like, well, we're meant to be doing ourselves out of a job. What are we doing? Constantly asking for more money, constantly doing more projects, constantly, you know, arguing about DFID budgets. So yeah, I don't know kind of what clearly I'm trying to say, but there's a lot of issues around intersectionality that sprung from my experience there that have kind of been a through line throughout the ensuing decades around my experience in academia, not really feeling welcome or a part of it. And then currently now my experience as, you know, as a UK citizen, as an immigrant, whose main projects are around public service access and how kind of minority ethnic communities do or do not have the ability to access services and provisions and rights. So it's weird to be a person who looks like the people I'm working for, but also has upward mobility and access to talk to people in power. It's a personally very challenging position, I find often. And I think that that really informs my work, this kind of intersectionality of myself as a researcher and a professional.
Yeah, it's so interesting. It does feel like, I mean, exactly that thing of intersectionality where there's all of these lines or grids locking against each other or through each other, and every single person's experience is different. Exactly, like how we present, you know, I'm a white woman, you're a brown woman, and people make these assumptions about who you are, but they don't necessarily know your background, and it's easy, it's kind of what is the easiest way to take you.
Yes.
And you mentioned, so can you tell a bit more about kind of how you made that transition into the UK and what it's like being of Bangladeshi descent and kind of working in this industry and how people have taken you? Because you definitely have, it's felt different, hasn't it, as from what you've told me before?
Yes, it's, so I came to, so I live, I was, I lived in the UK when I was in primary school. So I lived in London when I was young, and then we moved. So my dad has had a job where we moved every few years. So I've had the privilege of having an incredibly international upbringing, you know, which brings with it its own kind of, you know, burdens, I suppose. You're moving every few years and you kind of become a master of adaptation, and that's, you know, really served me well in lots of different contexts. But so I kind of moved here this time around to do my PhD in the late, in 2000, went to live, you know, moved to Oxford from Dhaka. I was working there at Brack University. I was teaching and doing development work, and I kind of at that point thought I really wanted to stay in teaching and research. And so, you know, at that point, you know, you've got to join the union, you've got to get yourself a PhD. So, you know, as an old mentor of mine said to me, it's like a union card, just go do it, go do your doctorate, and then you're a part of, member of the union, and then, you know, spread your wings. So I came to the UK and I've never left since then. So, you know, and I'm not going to dwell too long on this, but being at Oxbridge is definitely something that propelled me into what I do now, because I realized how inaccessible a world Oxbridge is. I mean, I went to Oxford as a grown-up. I went to do my PhD, but you know, you're surrounded by this kind of very hallowed halls and a very specific culture. And it's a culture that is very gatekeepy. It's a culture that is very specific around the things you know and the things you don't and the places you go and the places you don't. And I really felt like an outsider. And it was a very arresting experience for me because I knew all the privilege I held in the place that I came from and in general. And here I was, I felt like an outsider because, you know, I didn't know that you don't have port and something else and which way to pass the port and how important salad forks are. You know, I kind of knew how important salad forks are, but didn't really. So kind of that experience was quite isolating because I felt, again, very restricted. I had to kind of code switch to a very particular vision of myself so that, you know, it put others at ease around me. You know, it was a very, so I often talk about, like, you know, the don't scare the horses era, which is very much this, you know, this accent, you know, very westernized in many ways, very accessible to professional people here. And it's, you know, it's not all of me. And I think a lot of us who look like me feel that we can't really bring the whole of ourselves to our work, that we have to distill certain things that are palatable, certain things that are accessible. So kind of veering off, but I came out of my PhD feeling that academia wasn't the place I wanted to be. And, you know, kind of really having a career crisis of what do I want to do? At that point, I had met my now partner and I knew I wanted to stay on in the UK because the plan had been to go back to Bangladesh, carry on with my career there. And so I thought, well, what can I do? And just organically, small charities would say, you know, I knew someone who knew someone who said, hey, can you do a report for these guys? Can you do a bit of research for these guys? Can you, you know, look into this? And I thought, okay. And I wasn't really being paid much. But just the satisfaction I got from those things, I thought, okay, there's something here. Hmm. There's something here. And it was my into the charity sector in the UK. I saw that the charity sector goes from the behemoths, you know, like Save the Children, like, you know, Macmillan, that are huge, all the way down to community organizations that are tiny, and that there's a whole breadth of organizations that I could work with. Then the challenge came of, okay, often I would be talking to, when I was in the process of chatting to very white organizations, kind of really middle England charities that have been around for a long time. And ultimately I found that they're not the people I want to work for. And I know I don't know if this is shooting myself in the foot, but I found myself that I was most passionate for when I worked with small local charities who were addressing very specific needs in their community. So I think in terms of social justice, when we say the word, it can sound really big. You know, it can sound like a very overarching concept that is, you know, kind of a global conflict or things that are going on far away. But social justice is actually what's happening on the street outside us, what's happening in our communities, what's happening to the fact that people don't have enough food in a cost of living crisis, the fact that people aren't heating their homes, the fact that, you know, the stop and search issues around young offenders, issues around children, detention, asylum seekers, so much is going on in the UK that I felt that I could bring my skill set to on the ground problems here. And those are the kind of projects that I really like to do, working with community organizations in the UK.
So many things you've said, I'm also like, oh my goodness, yes, I completely get what you're saying. And, you know, even back to your experience at Oxford, because I also went to Oxford and as an undergraduate and coming from a state school background, I felt totally out of place there. I mean, there were all of these posh people and they, you know, I remember a very distinct meal when there was all this different cutlery and there was like a water bowl and I didn't really know what it was and I kind of put something in it accidentally. So there is that thing about that institution and about the people that are comfortable in that institution, which does pervade the rest of the main institutions that we have.
Exactly.
And yeah, and it's kind of, it really feels like that's kind of what I felt like when I went then into kind of the management consultancy industry. It was the same kind of values that were around in those companies. And what really frustrated me was this kind of idea that for those companies that were working in public sector and charitable sector, but they were doing it more because it was like another stream of revenue, right? It wasn't because...
Corporate social responsibility, yeah.
Yeah, but it was even just like, you know what, like this is, we already give our services to the corporates and we get lots of money that way, but then they basically realize there's loads of money in the charity sector as well. I mean, there's certainly not as much money, and we will talk about that as well, I think, later on. But
yeah,
but it kind of annoyed me that these organizations were kind of making profit out of organizations which, you know, were there to help people and
couldn't afford them.
And from the social justice people's perspective, or from those working in the charitable sector, they're like, they obviously see consultants as being really exploitative because they come from that kind of background, and they're like, well, we don't want to pay loads of money for some kind of like young Oxbridge, you know, person to kind of come and tell us what to do. But I still felt like there was a place for the role of consultancy in terms of being that critical friend. But it's these kind of things which made me very frustrated myself and what made me want to set up my organization, Justice Studio, because I felt like we need consultancies which are actually empathetic, there are so many things that are wrong about the wider business and kind of management and institutional levels in that and the way that they've been constructed, which make us think that we need to be different, or that we are different because we don't fit in there in a bad way. But actually, it's us recognizing, I think, that we maybe don't fit, or, you know, whatever, that helps us to be able to create organizations which are more listening and more empathetic, and can I would like to say kind of take the good things of consultancy, where they're really assisting and helping people to move forward, helping organizations to reflect and grow, but then still having that human touch and having that, like, showing that you actually genuinely care about their work, the people that they're trying to help, etc.
Yeah, I mean, there are great paradigms and tools that we can take from the wider consulting industry, and even kind of large scale development, you know, like the UN and, you know, lots of log frames, all that stuff. Like, you know, there's so many tools, and then we can apply them in a human way and in a humane way, and also apply them in a way that encompasses all of our own humanity. I think, you know, this is, you know, when I was reflecting on what we were going to talk about, something I kept coming back to is the idea of intersectionality, multiplicity, and humanity. And this all sounds really woo-woo as a business owner, but I think one of the things I really have struggled to do in most of my career, especially my career in the UK, has been, as I said, to bring the wholeness of myself to my work. Because the wholeness of myself is what makes me, I'm not going to say unique, but what might make me more effective, if we want to talk in, you know, business terms, or what might be my USP. You know, it is a USP to say, hey, I can be the interlocutor between minority ethnic communities and, let's say, a management room that is mostly white, mostly middle class, and mostly Oxbridge, right? I can speak both languages.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I want to use my ability to speak both languages, both metaphorically and, you know, figuratively, and, you know, literally in some cases, as a force for good, as a force multiplier, right? Like, that me bringing this fullness of identity and intersectionality and self is good business sense.
Mm-hmm.
If a charity wants to move into more inclusion activities, or kind of, you know, that they want to bring that as a pillar into their business, well, don't hire a white middle-class man from PwC to tell you how to do it. Like, I'm sorry. Like, there's so many amazing minority ethnic people from marginalized backgrounds working, who can not only give you the spiel from a technical point of view, but they can bring their lived experience as to what works.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of my philosophies around work and liberation and politics stems from that positionality. But as I was telling a friend, that it is a very fluid and constantly changing positionality to hold as a professional, because it depends on what room you're in and who you're talking to. Am I talking to power, and then to them I'm a gobby brown woman? Or am I talking to a room full of, you know, stakeholders and clients of an organization? Then I represent the organization to them. I represent the white people to them who are giving them charity, and my positionality completely changes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's being sensitive to this and harnessing this for the good of the organizations I work for, and to be a voice for clients who those organizations serve, because often those clients don't feel like they can talk to a member of the organization. And when you say, look, I'm a consultant, I'm a complete outsider, it's my job to tell them what to do better, they open up to you. And then if you look like them and if you speak their language, they open up to you more. And that can be whether you're a woman, if you're, you know, dealing with a women's charity, and if you're a person of color, if you're a woman and a person of color and you happen to be Muslim, and all of those things stack on top of each other. So I'm really passionate. I really think that we who do kind of boutique consulting or kind of small values-led consulting, we shouldn't forget that. We shouldn't forget that who we are is what makes our organizations different.
Mm.
You know, and I struggle to find the balance of, you know, when I'm selling my services, if you will, to push that, because, you know, I've lived here for over 15 years now, and, you know, I've really absorbed the British, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
Self-deprecating.
Yeah, that whole thing, like, exactly. And you know, and then as a woman, you're constantly like, well, I hope that makes sense. When you know that's made sense, I really reaffirm your thing that who we are and those kind of conflicts within us is what makes us good at what we do, because we haven't lost that desire to be, I'm going to say the word authentic and cringe a little bit, but, yeah, but authentic.
Yeah. And I think for me, it's taken time as well to have confidence to be able to be comfortable with the fact that I maybe have, you know, different values or whatever, or I have different things to offer, or, you know, I don't need to keep being self-deprecating. Actually, to be honest, I think I probably still suffer from this, but then I'm kind of like so typically English, it's kind of disgusting. But I think it's tricky for us when we come from these small organizations and we're competing because we work in a competitive industry with these very, you know, with the big boys, right? We're competing often with the big boys who people know their names. People implicitly trust them just because their names are so famous. And yet we know that they don't necessarily have the nuance. They don't necessarily have the care. They don't necessarily have the maybe the... Yeah, I mean, it's a lot more formulaic, you know, it's kind of, you know, we have this matrix and we're going to apply it to your business, where I think the whole point of our work is that we really do want to be more of a conduit between what are the people on the ground saying and try to be more that messenger, I would say, between and that kind of that being that fluid person between talking, as you say, to the people at the top and the people who are, you know, who are kind of affected by everything. And that takes a lot more diplomacy. It takes a lot more, I don't know. It just takes a lot more time and it takes a lot more
energy, nuance, energy, time, all of it. Yeah. It's trying to do a job well, and it takes time and energy. And then if you're trying to do it with integrity, even more time and energy.
And then we're not good at talking about it. I mean, I feel like Justice Studio has been appalling at talking about the work that it's done. We've just been heads down doing loads of work. And then we, you know, when you look back, you're like, wow, we've done over 100 projects. We've worked in like over 30 countries. We've done so much work. But actually, people on the outside wouldn't really have a clue about that because we haven't really talked about it. We haven't done that thing of self-promotion. We've been terrible at it, and in the end that can cause a real problem because then people don't necessarily know who you are and things like that. So I think that there is something about getting more confident, like in yourself and in your business, which is an important factor, which we come at from more of a back position than those people who are already, you know, fluent and big and, you know, part of the big boy network, if you see what I mean. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things when we had our, you know, preliminary chat, we were talking about is what are the difficulties of running this kind of business? And, you know, first of all, I'd like to say, you know, Justice, whenever you look at your website, just not even speaking to you in person, it's amazing the breadth of the work. You know, I'm a one man, you know, one woman band, and not being able to promote the work that we do, it's because we're so small, right? Like, you know, I often say I'm back office, I'm payroll, I'm chasing invoices, I'm chasing business, I'm the project team. You know, I might subcontract some data analysis out or some, you know, but I'm the one who does it. I'm the one who does the work, right? And in some cases, you know, I'll collaborate with my co-founder, but he also has his own stuff that he does with the UN, and that takes up a lot of his time. So it is just the structural reality of running the businesses we do that doesn't leave time for the promotion because, you know, and I kind of wrote a bullet point here, like we're running to stand still. Because if we're trying to make enough money to live in London, like let's be real, to live in London, to pay rent or pay mortgage, in my case, I have a family, then it is overwhelming, even with the privilege of, you know, a two income family. So you just get stuck in to do the work.
Yeah.
And That's your days. Your days are doing the work. And then even before one thing has ended, you're like, oh my God, we need new work.
Yeah.
How are we going to keep the lights on? We need a new project. And then you're chasing that. And so then the stuff that is business development work, like promotion, like connection, all of that business development stuff falls by the wayside because you're also doing all of the other stuff that you should probably have a team of, in my case, a few people doing it. But it's that chicken and egg thing. Oh, my business isn't big enough for me to hire people to do XYZ. But if you don't hire people to do XYZ, it doesn't get done.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real challenge. I find myself running to stand still. Mm-hmm. And, you know, recently I've kind of really scaled back, and I know you have as well, on work. And again, I'm going to put up top, I have the privilege of, you know, being able to take a break to reevaluate and focus on other things. But it was because I was just tired of tenders and competing. And it ended up that the jobs I would get were because someone met me and had a great conversation with me. And I said, well, this is what I do. And they said, oh my God, can you send me your CV? Oh, can I have a look at your website? Oh my God, we're looking for someone to do this. And those are the projects I ended up enjoying the most, that I got the most out of, that I feel the client got the most out of, because again, I'm going to use a woo-woo word. There were vibes. They met me and saw something in me that they connected with personally and organizationally.
Yeah.
That doesn't come across on a tender.
No.
Right? There was just, you know, a meeting of, oh, you're the kind of person we want to do this thing. Right. Okay. And then, you know, you go through the process, and obviously, you know, you write up your proposal, you talk through it, you agree on money and all that stuff. All of this takes time and effort, right? Like, and on the side, you still have to keep tendering because you don't know. And that's the other thing, right? In our business, you don't know what projects you're going to get.
Exactly.
You might be running after something for months, and in the end, you don't get it.
Yeah.
And that's all unpaid work. That is all unpaid time and effort you've put into writing the proposal, making the contacts, writing the emails, having the coffee. And then they might give it to someone else, or they might ultimately not get the funding to do the thing. So I find it incredibly frustrating to work the way we do. And I don't know what we're going to do about that. Like, how do we make our businesses sustainable and still work with the kind of organizations and values we want to?
Yeah, I resonate with everything you've said. I feel like, and this keeps happening, like when I talk to you, I'm like, yes, 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 yes. I totally, totally, totally feel the same. And also, by the way, I'm like very happy with Woo. I'm like all about Woo. So go ahead with that. But in terms of like this constant cycle, which is there even when you're a sole trader as well as somebody with a small team, you still get into this cycle of we're doing work. Oh, we've done the work. Oh, we need to get work. Okay, we'll write proposals. We'll get some work. Oh, no, now we have to do the work. And it's kind of this like never-ending kind of undulation between getting work and doing work. And you're always in this frenetic mode of that kind of consequence, and it can be very, very tiring. And then, yeah, exactly, when in the time when you're doing all of the projects versus writing loads of proposals to get new projects, do you have time to kind of talk about the work that you've actually done or reflect on it and kind of, you know, do all of the things that you are meant to do around communications when you're kind of in the midst of it? And I think that's what has been for me the thing that's just constantly been an issue, is that we can't do all of these things when you're a small team.
Yeah,
because even my team gets caught up in it, you know, and communications always feels like the last thing to do. It's always like a nice to have thing.
Exactly.
But then what I've realized then is that we're in this situation whereby we're striving ahead and we're not attracting. So I mean, of course, like there are those projects where you meet people and you're like, this vibes, and you know, this would be a good match. They are the best projects because you already have that mutual respect and you're not competing with loads of other people.
Exactly.
Like, hey, look at me, and I can kind of give you these rates, et cetera, et cetera. So I definitely love those projects. I love repeat projects. Any projects where people come to you because they've kind of heard of you or they know about you, mm-hmm. I feel like they are the best projects. And what I've started to realize is there's like these two different strategies. There's the strategy where you are, you know, you're like this kind of general in the army and you're kind of like going out and you're like getting work and you're competing and this kind of thing that we've been taught to do. But then there is this other strategy, which I've been trying. I mean, I don't know how good I am at it, where you sit back and you conserve your energy more. And then you start talking about what you're doing. And it's more about actually placing communications more right at the center of what you're doing, mm-hmm. and hoping that the more you explain about what you do, the more people will realize who you are, and then they'll kind of come to you. So it's like this more of like an attraction rather than a forging ahead kind of strategy. And that's what I've been trying to cultivate as I myself just got so worn out by the whole thing. And as I said, even with the small team, I think I realized that because I started off like this, in this kind of mode, like I was doing so much work, I was kind of happy to take low fees, I was just like, I just really care about the work, so I'm just going to keep doing it. And I ended up, you know, and we ended up always overworking, over delivering. However, we never really felt massively appreciated in that at the same time. And so it was just kind of, we were all kind of exhausted. And I felt like even my team was being constructed in the same manner that I had been. It was like I kind of cut them from the same cloth almost, and we were in this cycle. Mm-hmm. And something just had to give. And I realized that I need to really step back and just think totally the opposite of like, of how we've been. And that thing that you said about competing, I think, is really interesting, because it's like this, like one of those, it's like that value, this value within economics, within business, that you have to compete, and that is the best thing, mm-hmm. which I'm kind of just beginning to not like. And I feel like it's a patriarchal value. It's like this idea that we do have to compete with each other. I don't think that's necessarily true. I don't think it's necessarily healthy for the public sector and the charity sector, especially when you've got two women's rights charities, for example, putting loads of effort into a proposal, putting loads of resources that they don't have into months and months and months of a really big proposal, and then another one's doing it at the same time, and they're both applying for it, but only one is going to get it, and the rest, you know, and it's just totally not worth the other people's time. I feel like it's a real waste, and it's not the right way of doing things. And it's similar in our industry as well. As you say, you know, you kind of can work really, really hard on a proposal. You can do loads of stuff. I mean, I've even gone to Malawi for a proposal in order to do research and things.
Oh, wow.
You know, and so you do all this work and then you don't get it. And it's like, I feel like we've kind of uncritically accepted this value of competition as being the best, but it doesn't really fit in this industry.
No, I think you're right. And as you were talking, I was thinking about as well that, you know, when you add into that wanting to live, you know, and this is kind of not around the business, it's around life, wanting to live a values-led life around the combination of work and family and home and my personal being, then what does that look like? What does that balance look like? And that's kind of where I am right now, is there are ways to build a business that we've all been taught, you know, throw bleep at the wall and see what sticks, which is the, you know, pitch for every tender you see going that feels vaguely relevant to you, and then you burn yourself out. The second thing you're talking about, you know, put yourself into the world and see what comes. But all of this feels really uncertain, right? Like all of it feels like, can I trust myself to work in a way that feels authentic to me and believe that it will be, quote, successful, right? And by success, I mean sustainable financially, rewarding. And I haven't found that balance yet. And I think especially when, you know, so I had my daughter a few years ago, and then when you bring in, this is another rant I could go on, you know, childcare fees in this country, England is not built for two working, you know, the UK is not built for two working parents, and the sacrifices that mostly mums have to make around their professional careers in the early years of having children, how does that balance with being a business owner and doing values-driven work, often with small organisations who don't have their own infrastructure and who don't have their own systems built? So, and that for me has often translated into running endlessly after invoices, project creep. Oh, can you also do this? Oh, by the way, would you come and do this workshop for us? Well, are you paying me my day rate?
Yeah.
If not, no. I can't roll this into the already terrible rates that I'm getting, you know, and that thing of, if one truly believes in the work one's doing, my gut instinct is to be like, okay, I'll knock off X amount from my day rate. Okay, we'll do the project for this amount of money. But ultimately, we have to be sustainable financially.
Yeah.
Right? What does that look like? Because also then I don't know if it's a woman thing, it's also that thing of, well, I can't ask for that much. And it was the first time I thought I was being paid my due was actually a female-led fellow consulting organization who just said to me, can you come in and collaborate with us on a project? And I said, yeah, great. And then they said, well, what's your day rate? And I told them, and they went, what? You're worth more than that. And they, off their own back, paid me £100 over.
Oh, wow.
What I was asking for.
That's amazing. Day.
Because they're, no, they're like, no, this is not okay. Because, you know, they, we felt, again, like we recognized each other. They're like, no, you have all of this work experience. You've got a PhD. No, this is not okay. Like, no, we're going to pay you. And it was such a validating moment.
Mm.
And since then, I'm like, well, this is my day rate. It's what it is. But all of these things are difficult because one is doing them in isolation, often in our living rooms or in a co-working space. You know, it's hard to find the confidence to do those things and feel supported in doing those things because we're also so concerned with being a business that is accessible to the kind of people we want to help. Like it's all these conflicting things that one is often balancing alone, which is why, you know, I think it's important if we can to be in community with other like-minded business owners, with other like-minded consultants, because then we can share and we can be like, oh my God, you too. And I find that really, really helpful. But I think we often undersell the difficulty of the task we're trying to do. And I think we shouldn't. I think we should kind of pat ourselves on the back and say, we are trying to push a boulder uphill. And that's why it's hard. Not because we're not good enough, not because we can't do the work, because the thing we've taken on is really difficult.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's partly that thing of being, I feel like we're both trying to do something different, but we're in an environment which is already set up in a way that completely conflicts with what we want to do. And it's that balance between how do you navigate, you know, a very competitive, hierarchical, like, you know, business world coupled with, you know, for you, for example, with this place that assumes that you're going to have somebody at home looking after the kids and then the other person is going to work. And that's how work is really set up still. It hasn't really changed.
Yeah.
Different from, you know, the 1950s, as it were. And with the pay, this has been my challenge for so long. I definitely, when I first started out, was charging very little for what I did. And then as I went on, I tried to charge more, but you do actually come up against some of the infrastructural things. Mm-hmm. Again, because, you know, for example, with the public sector, there is a big pressure on them not to be paying, you know, massive fees to people. So they'll have their caps. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you're doing certain work with certain organizations, it might be, you know, UN, or it might be the government, or it might be kind of, you know, certain charities or whatever, they'll have their particular day rates that, you know, you can't really go above. So there's that, and you're not competing really in this sector with the commercial sector, whereby kind of anything goes because they have their own, you know, rules, whatever. And so that is a challenge. And then coupled with that pressure from the institution, there's your own like self-worth and like self-validation, mm-hmm. self-esteem about what can I actually charge. And I think it takes, for me, it's taken years, and I feel like I'm, again, only just starting to maybe charge what I feel I'm worth or feel like I'm happy to work for. And that has been a really difficult journey. And even when I've had, you know, so many difficulties with cash flow and things like that, when I've had staff and I've had to be kind of thinking about paying their, you know, salaries, and, you know, you kind of have these nights when you're like, oh my goodness, are we going to make payroll and this kind of stuff? It's like, the money isn't plentiful in this industry. So you're just kind of, it's a real conflict, I think, isn't it? It's like we're trying to assert ourselves, but at the same time, we're doing it within a framework, which is very challenging.
Absolutely. The budgets that the organizations we would like to work for often that they have in no way reflect the expertise that they, and this is the civil service, you know, this is the public sector as well.
Yeah.
In no way reflect the expertise that they're trying to get hold of to do the work. Like,
yeah.
And then you don't want to be in the position of applying for something and convincing the client, convincing the organization that what they're asking for is too much, because then that's another, you know, whole conversation or many conversations that you're having with a client that don't always go well. So I think the older I get, the more I'm like, know when to walk away.
Yeah, I think it's really important to know when to say no, that this isn't the right thing. I mean, something I've also done in those circumstances is I've kind of said, okay, well, this is what I can do for that budget.
Exactly.
You know, this is how much it would cost if I did all of, you know, whatever else you want, and give them different options. But I think there is sometimes a misconception by the commissioner that they don't necessarily know what work goes into projects.
No.
And it certainly as well, if they've not commissioned any consultancy projects before or research projects before, they'll just be like, exactly, we have like this spare $2,000, we have this spare $10,000, whatever, and we'll like, let's just do an evaluation with it. And they,
yeah, and we need you to talk to stakeholders, staff, do a 360, you know, chat with all the management team, interview every board member, and you're like,
yeah,
that's $10,000 right there, the data gathering, that's your $10,000.
Yeah,
let alone the analysis and writing the report and strategy review.
Exactly. And so I think it's kind of just comes from sometimes, yeah, them just not necessarily knowing the amount of work or time that some of these things take. And even in the past, I've certainly been like thinking that things will take me less time than they do, and they can take more time, and other people can, you know, it's hard also sometimes to imagine how much time it's going to take somebody that's maybe just starting out as well. If you've got different team members, you don't know. I know maybe I roughly get how long things will take me now, but I always, yeah, I feel like I never completely know. And so there is that sense of, well, actually, who ends up taking the brunt of that? It usually ends up being up. But yeah, it's a tricky thing. And then there is as well that late, as you say, that point of wanting, you know, caring about this industry and caring about the work that you do, not just wanting it to be really thorough and, you know, have real academic rigor, but also just the fact that you care about the end people that are meant to be being helped, that you care about the values of the organization, you care about the goals of the organization. And so there is this sense that, you know, we want to help the wider picture, and so we'll kind of slightly sacrifice ourselves for it, you know. Yeah. And I definitely feel like at times I felt like a bit of a, I mean, I think I have definitely felt like a martyr in many different ways almost, which is not healthy, but you just kind of, you end up just taking on a bit of the brunt and the burden when you don't need to, really, I think sometimes. Or maybe that saying no thing, which is a really learned thing to do, like learning to say no, putting up your boundaries, knowing what your boundaries are, that takes some time and some confidence. And yeah, and if you and it can mean that sometimes you get like that, I don't know, you have to be kind of, I don't know, sometimes hurt in your boundaries before you assert them, if you know what I mean. Yeah.
No, it's difficult. It's difficult from a multiple angles. There's the thing of like, oh, am I saying no to money, right? Like there's this constant worry as a small business owner, because there is, you know, no one to fall back on, right? We're trained in a capitalist system to constantly hustle.
Yeah.
And there is such a glorification of hustle culture, especially for small business owners. Like, you know, if you're not eating, breathing, sleeping your business, are you even grinding, you know, that?
Mm.
And it's so easy to feel like we're not doing enough if you're not growing your business, if you're not, you know, putting money away in a certain way, if you're not getting bigger and bigger projects. And when you couple that internal driver that is, you know, created by, it is an internal driver, but it's completely validated and created by the society we live in. And when you couple that with the fact that often the very same organization who would pay PwC or KPMG or whoever more money to do the same work is unwilling to pay you that money, because you're a smaller organization, even though I know in my bones I will do a 3 times better and more dedicated job. Like I've had this conversation with someone who said, yeah, but if we get one of the big people in, even if it's for like a third of the project scope that you might be able to do, we can tell our funders that, oh, KPMG came in and did this evaluation. And that immediately communicate something to the funders, right? Oh, this is a serious organization. They've had KPMG in, right? Oh, they're serious. Okay, right? So we're fighting so many embedded layers. And I've had someone say, oh my God, you're amazing. I would love to have you. And I know you have the skills to do it, but I need a recognizable branded consultancy so I can go to my funders and say, look who we got in.
Wow.
You know, to kind of show to my funders that we're a serious organization and we have a stamp of approval from, you know, it's like that thing of Oxbridge, right? The minute, you know, like I'm forever amazed by just saying the name and people just go, oh, Like, you know, I'm always kind of bringing them down to earth and saying, you know, go to the university that best suits the thing you want to do. Don't go to Oxbridge because of the name. You know, and people are always surprised because brands carry so much weight. And that's true in our business as well, right? Brands and size carry so much weight. So
yeah,
it is rolling a boulder uphill because people want, you know, big organizations, they want recognizable, especially if they're going for funding to things like Big Lottery or, you know, government funds or Joseph Rancher, whoever, right? Like if they're going to very big established funding organizations, they want to show those organizations due diligence. And due diligence can mean the stamp of approval from a big consulting firm. So when we're battling, you know, their internal pressures as well, you know, their internal business pressures as well as the thing. So, you know, all of this to say, why do we even do what we do? I think it's, of course, it's valuable. Of course, I find satisfaction in my work. But I think the more I can't, you know, the kind of the older I get, the more I'm able to say no, the more I'm able to be okay with less work, but that's valuable work. And if I don't have a project on deck, you know, three projects on deck constantly, that's okay. Like, you know, one of the things I wrote in my notes is, you know, it's also great to collaborate with other small consulting shops, like, you know, Thoughtful Content or Research Your Way, or maybe you guys, you know, it's, there are often projects we can't do on our own because it's too much or too big. So I think it's also about, for me at the end of the day, taking the ego out of it a little bit and saying, what do I really want to do? Do I really want to work for people who don't appreciate what I do? Or do I want to give myself that permission to say no and to be selective? And it's really hard to do that because we're all part of hustle culture. We're all part of, you know, bigger, better, more. I'm as much a victim of that as anyone else.
Yeah, I mean, it makes so much sense. But I think you're right. It's working together and it's collaborating with each other. And I mean, even just to talk to another person that has similar views is very heartening, I think, sometimes, because when you're in this environment where it's like you have to compete against each other, you don't necessarily talk about these things or about your vulnerabilities or about, you know, some of the frustrations. Mm-hmm. And so even just to chat about it can be really nice, because you're like, oh, we've kind of noticed a similar thing, and we're questioning it in a way that's not necessarily talked about on a more wider scale. So I think it's really important.
It's easy to kind of be in our silos, right? Like, it's that thing of running to stand still. And you were saying, like, you just do the work, you get the work, you do the work, you get the work, you do the work. And
yeah,
everyone's on the hamster wheel and all in our own home offices and in our own co-working spaces, just doing the work.
Yeah.
And I think what you're doing now with this podcast and reaching out to different people in the industry, different people doing interesting work, trying to, you know, show people the work that Justice Studio has done, I think all of this, like I was thinking earlier today, like all of this is community building in a part of the industry that we often don't have community in, because frankly, we don't have the time.
Yeah.
You know, that's the honest truth. We don't have the time. We're all too busy, you know, barely getting by to build communities. You know, what you're doing through this podcast, hopefully, is a part of that coming together and talking about the industry, talking about things we like, things we don't, things we want to kind of promote, things we want to change. And I genuinely believe that community building, you know, is the way forward, because otherwise we'll all be in our silos doing our work and then not telling enough people about it.
Yeah, no, completely. I'm so glad that you think that. And also, for me, it's been just great to actually remember the projects that we've done and really live back the excitement of some of the projects that we've done, because I think over the years, you know, and obviously we've kind of slightly frustratedly ranted at each other a bit about all of the difficulties, but there have actually been some really exciting and interesting moments where I've learned loads, where, you know, where it's been a project which I felt like, oh yeah, maybe that has helped. I don't know, maybe it hasn't, but at least I felt like it really added something to my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, I think so perhaps we should kind of wrap up now, because I feel like we've covered a lot of stuff, but
yeah,
just so that we're not, you know, you're also, you know, we're not just thinking about the negatives. It would be great if maybe you could just help us close by just talking about a project that, you know, that does inspire you when you think back on it, and more about what that's given you, like some of the positives of some of the work that you've done.
think I'm thinking back to a project I did quite a few years ago, and I'm not going to name the organization, but it was a project that basically was looking into the access that Muslim youth had to mental health services in the UK. And it was a research project where I was responsible for kind of talking to the NHS and mental health services. So that side of the equation, so not the young people, the providers, the service providers. And I ended up talking to probably about 40 or 50 different mental health service providers across the country. And it really affected me deeply. First of all, it was a project that really grounded me in kind of the UK in terms of, you know, public sector and what's happening on the ground, and with, especially with, you know, minority ethnic populations. It reminded me that service provision, charity projects, they're about people. It sounds so basic, but the reason we do the work we do is so that people have better outcomes at the base level. And going and talking to health professionals who are often incredibly dedicated, had spent 30, 40 years of their life working in, you know, child and adolescent mental health services and early adult mental health services, given their whole careers, and basically either felt incredibly inspired by the work they did or felt incredibly like they hadn't, you know, that had been a drop in the ocean and they hadn't done any good. And being able to talk to them all, step back and say, okay, what is happening with mental health services? A, and B, why are minority ethnic young people not being able to access the services? And, you know, we can talk about the results. You know, there's issues around Islamophobia, issues around, you know, very poor community understanding of mental health and feeling a lot of shame within the community. And then there's the issue of, you know, wanting to be perceived as a good immigrant. You know, you don't want to rock the boat, you don't want to cause trouble. It was just a very intricate, interlayered project that made me realize that doing good work is incredibly rewarding, but is incredibly hard. And especially work that does what I want to do and is a bridge between communities that are often ignored, vulnerable, minimized, not listened to, and people who can actually make policy that helps them. You know, and I think that kind of set a template for how I want to feel when I'm working. Does that make sense, right? Like, mm-hmm. and so I carry that with me. I carry those voices with me. And I think, you know, it's a constant reminder that there's work to be done everywhere. I kind of want to focus on connecting organizations that really need people like us, but often can't afford us, to us. Mm. And I don't know if the answer is an intermediary organization that pays us so that we don't, I don't know. Mm. But I think my focus has become much more local over time, because I think that's where I can see impact much more.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. I do think that there is something very important about being local and being on the ground and just, you know, doing what you can in and seeing how we can change or hopefully make things better in the smallest ways possible, because actually they can be the biggest sometimes.
Because it's easy to feel helpless. You know, I think currently with what's going on globally, it's so easy to kind of look at that and feel like we are powerless. So I combat that by saying, well, what are the small things I can do that really hopefully will impact people's lives? And I know your work has done that too. So take more time to tell us all about the amazing work that Justice Studio has done, because we need to hear about it.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, and it's been so amazing to speak. It's been so interesting. And I've loved hearing about, you know, all of the stuff. And I do feel it's so interesting that we are on the same page about a lot of stuff. But yeah, I'm sure that loads of people want to find out more about you and know how they can get in touch with you. So where can they find you? Can you give us links to any places that people can follow you?
Yes, so I'm sure Marianne will put links in show notes, but you can find me on my website, which is www.inclusivegrowth.co, not .com or .co.uk, .co, and that has my email on the website. Also, you can add me on LinkedIn, so there'll be a link to that. I'm Dr. Iram Ali on LinkedIn, and that has, you know, loads of information about my work and kind of what I do. So yeah, send me a message on LinkedIn, find me on my website, drop me an email. I'm trying to be more active on it's now X, but I'm failing miserably. So yeah, so LinkedIn and email are the best places to find me. And if you think that if you've heard something you like about my work or how I approach my work, I would love to have a chat with folks about how we can work together or just have a chat and connect. So yeah, it's been great. Thank you so much, Marianne, for having me. It's been a real privilege, and hopefully this conversation's kind of made people feel less alone, or made, you know, people in our field, you know, feel seen and say, yeah, me too, because that would be amazing. Come build community with us.
Yes, do come. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that was the end of series one of Justice Studio Sessions. I really hope you enjoyed all 15 episodes, and we will be back. I'm not exactly sure when, but at some point we will be back. So do stay following us, and one day you will get the nice surprise of a new episode arriving. Until then, bye-bye. Thank you for listening to Justice Studio Sessions. We have so enjoyed deep diving into social justice with you. Justice Studio provides compassionate consultancy rooted in social justice. If you would like to work with us, please visit our website at www.justicestudio.org or email us at info@justicestudio.org. This podcast relies on your support. If you love our content and would like to see this podcast reach more people, please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating or leave us a lovely review. We would be delighted for you to share your thoughts, musings, or favourite parts of the podcast with us on social media. You can tag and or follow Marianne at creatrix.london and Justice Studio at Justice Studio on all the major social sites. This podcast was hosted by Marianne Moore and produced by Justice Studio Limited. The music was by Luke Fraser at The Tonic, and the artwork was by Marianne. Thank you so much for listening.